From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, one of the biggest pop hitmakers of the 70s and early 80s, Barry Manilow. He's been the object of adoration as well as the butt of jokes. Among his 25 top 40 hits are Mandy, Daybreak, I Write the Songs, This Song's for You, and Copacabana. Before he was a performer, he wrote advertising jingles and was Bette Midler's music director. He has a new CD and DVD. Then film critic David Edelstein reviews Man on Fire, starring Denzel Washington, and considers Hollywood's infatuation with revenge films. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. North Korea has made a rare appeal for international help after a massive explosion at a train station that it says has killed hundreds of people and injured thousands. NPR's Rob Gifford reports the secretive country still has revealed almost nothing about what caused yesterday's blast and the extent of the damage.
We really don't have anything to go on. They're not allowing foreign journalists in there. They are on Saturday, tomorrow, inviting aid agencies to go up to the site of the blast, so we could get some more information tomorrow. But without any real access for journalists, it's been very difficult to find out exactly the basis and the reason for this accident taking place.
NPR's Rob Gifford in Dandong, China, near the North Korean border. Today, President Bush visited the Florida Everglades, where on the second day of an environmental push, he pledged to expand the nation's wetlands. Environmentalists criticized the tour as a swing state photo op and assailed the administration's environmental record. Mr. Bush also attended fundraisers in Florida that brought in more than $4 million for Republican candidates. His own campaign has raised more than $180 million. Despite a sharp warning today from the Vatican aimed at Catholic politicians who back abortion rights, Catholic senator and Democratic presidential contender John Kerry reaffirmed his support for such rights at a rally in Washington, D.C. We have more from NPR's David Wellna.
Kerry told a large rally of women who plan to march here Sunday for abortion rights that the clock will not be turned backwards. He condemned President Bush's recent recess appointments of federal judges who've publicly stated their opposition to abortion.
In the year 2004, we deserve a president who understands that a stronger America, where women's rights are just that, rights, not political weapons to be used by politicians in this nation.
Just hours before Kerry spoke, a cardinal at the Vatican declared that Catholic politicians who back abortion rights are not fit to receive communion. Kerry's spokesman said the senator intends to keep practicing his faith while at the same time believing in the separation of church and state. David Wellna, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush has eased economic sanctions on Libya imposed during the Reagan presidency. The change, which comes in response to Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's decision to give up weapons of mass destruction, lets American companies conduct a wide range of commercial activities involving Libya, and it will let oil imports from Libya resume. The Bush administration has bluntly told Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to abide by his earlier pledge not to harm Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Sharon had declared he was no longer bound to the commitment. Last week, President Bush endorsed Sharon's plan to pull out of Gaza and some West Bank settlements to the anger of Palestinians. Today, the Dow Industrials gained 11 points, closing at 10,472 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite was up 16 at 2,049. From Washington, this is NPR News. The National Transportation Safety Board says the federal government has inadequate maintenance and inspection procedures for aircraft used to fight wildfires. That comes in a new report about three air tanker crashes in the last decade, which killed eight firefighters. NPR's Howard Berkus has details.
The National Transportation Safety Board says the nation's fleet of wildfire aircraft requires better maintenance and inspection, especially given the advanced age of the planes and the stresses they encounter during firefighting duty. The Federal Safety Agency urges wildfire agencies to include aircraft age, design limits, and operational stresses in safety assessments. The recommendations are made in a response to three air tanker accidents in which fatigue cracking is blamed for wings breaking off in flight. The air tanker fleet includes former military planes that are decades old. their stress by heavy loads of water and fire retardant and diving and climbing maneuvers. Some of the planes were grounded after two crashes 2 years ago killed five crew members. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has approved a proposal that would let employers reduce or eliminate medical coverage for retirees once they qualify for Medicare. AARP, which represents millions of seniors, says it means benefits could be jeopardized, and spokesman Michael Naylor says it's a grievous mistake that the AARP will fight.
Sit down either with the employers or with the EEOC and try to come up with some sort of reasonable balance in this area. If we can't resolve that, well, then legal action, I think, is very likely.
Unions and employers support the proposal. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt, smoothies, and cultured soy. 10% of profits are donated to support environmental causes and family farms. Details at stonyfield.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Well, good evening. It is I, the ultimate Manilow.
Barry Manilow is one of the most successful pop performers of the 70s and early 80s. He had 25 top 40 hits between 1974 and 83, including Mandy, I Write the Songs, Trying to Get the Feeling Again, Looks Like We Made It, Daybreak, Can't Smile Without You, Copacabana, and I Made It Through the Rain. Before he started writing and singing pop songs, he wrote commercial jingles, and he was Bette Midler's first music director. He stopped recording his own songs in the 80s. There didn't seem to be much interest in them anymore. But he's had something of a revival in recent years. Now he has a new concert DVD called Ultimate Manilow and a new concert CD set called Two Nights Live.
Her name is Lola. She was a showgirl with yellow feathers in her hair and a dress cut down to there. She would merengue and do the cha-cha. And while she tried to be a star, Tony always tended to bar across the crowded floor. They worked from 8 till 4. They were young and they had each other. Who could ask for more at the Copa? Copacabana, the hottest spot north of Havana. At the Copa, Copacabana. Music and fashion were always the fashion at the Copa. They fell in love. His name was Rico. He wore a diamond. He was escorted to his chair. He saw Lola dancing there. And when she finished, he called her over. No, but Rico went a bit too far. Tony sailed across the bar. And then the punches flew. And chairs were smashed in two. There was blood and a single gunshot. But just who shot who? At the Copa, Copacabana. The hottest spot north of
That's Copacabana from Barry Manilow's new concert CD, Two Nights Live. Terry spoke with Barry Manilow in 2002.
Well, suddenly you're really high profile again.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I will. Have you ever seen my profile? Sorry. I am high profile. I am as hot as a knish. And it is surprising everybody, most of all me. Because, you know, I've been making albums like this for, you know, 20-some-odd years. And I've been touring every few years for that time. And they've all been, you know, successful in one way or another. But nothing has, it's never exploded quite like this. And I can't really give you a reason why.
When I picked up your Ultimate Manilow record, the greatest hits record, I looked at the songs on the back and I thought, well, I know that one. Don't know this one, don't know this one. But when I played it, I realized that I knew the ones that I didn't think I knew. I just didn't remember them by title.
Oh, I have insinuated my little self into your brains over the last 20 years.
Well, but that's the thing. I mean, you know, your songs were everywhere. I mean, they were on the radio, they were on TV, they were in stores and probably in elevators. I mean, they were just
They were in elevators. I'm sure they were in elevators, yes. No, it's true. And, you know, I hadn't even listened to these records. You know, I sing them nightly, but they're not, you know, they don't sound exactly like the old records did. And I actually, somebody was playing it, and I actually listened to it, and they all sound pretty good. I mean, you know, Weekend in New England sounds pretty good, even, you know, all these years later.
What are some of the most unusual places you've heard your songs?
That's a great question. Some of the most unusual places. Well, you know, I must say that, you know, I have heard it in restaurants and unusual places. I don't know, you know, in big stadiums. Sometimes they do it in big stadiums and of course, in, you know, boutiques karaoke bars. That was pretty awful, I must say. It was some very bad singer trying to do I Write the Songs. It was really, I had to leave.
Well, what were you doing there in the first place? Why were you in a karaoke
bar? I didn't know
bar?
It was a karaoke bar. It was a Mexican restaurant, and then suddenly somebody got up and sang. I hope they didn't know that I was there.
That's really funny. So somebody was singing, I Write the Songs, did you say?
I Write the Songs, yes. It was lovely. Oh. Actually, the karaoke part wasn't bad, though. The track that they sing to wasn't bad.
The funny thing about I Write the Songs, people associate that song with you because you recorded it, but you didn't write I Write the Songs.
I did not. And I knew it was going to get me in trouble as soon as Clive showed. You know, my hit record experience is all, I give the credit to Clive Davis, who was the president of Arista while I was there. And when I went on to Arista Records, I really knew nothing about pop music at all. My first single was Could It Be Magic, a song that I based on a Chopin prelude, and it came in at 8 minutes long. So what did I know about pop music? So, you know, you're supposed to have a 3-minute record. But when Clive started to work with me, he actually taught me the ins and outs of how to have a hit record. And he would submit songs to me so that I would arrange and produce and sing these outside pieces of material, even though I considered myself a songwriter. And I Write the Songs was one of the ones he gave me, and I knew I was going to get in trouble if I accepted this, because first of all, I figured everybody was going to think that I was screaming about how I write all the songs in the world. What does he think he is, Burt Bacharach? You know? I didn't write I Write the Songs, but Bruce Johnson of the Beach Boys wrote it, and when I sang it, I knew what he was trying to get to. He's saying the spirit of music is really the creator of everything, you know, of all composers' work, and I believe that, too. I believe that when I'm writing, I have nothing to do with it. I'm just taking dictation. I loved that idea, but I didn't think anybody listening to I Write the Songs would really understand that. And I was right. Most people actually thought that I was singing about myself. And it didn't seem to bother anybody either, but it's true. I didn't write I Write the Songs.
Are you sorry you recorded it? Or
No. I think over the years, I think people really get a big pleasure out of it.
Why don't we hear a little bit of I Write the Songs? Did a lot of the arranging on your songs. I mean, before you were even a singer, you were an arranger and music director. Talk a little bit about the kind of production you liked on your records, on your pop
records. I like emotional productions. Mm-hmm. I like to take a listener on a trip. I don't like, you know, a lot of the records that I hear are like one feeling. They start with a groove, and 3 minutes later, nothing has happened except a groove. I've never been able to do that. Some of them I like. Some of them I like that kind of thing, and a lot of people do it very well today. But that's not my thing. I really like for your heart to start to beat a little faster, and I like to make you have goosebumps now and again. I like to convey the passion that I have for my music to you, the listener, and that's what I have always loved, and that's what I've always done with my arranging. I've always started it on one level and tried to take it someplace so that by the end of the song, you've gone somewhere with me.
Now, let's talk about your early musical life. Your first instrument was, I think, accordion?
I'm sorry.
What happened?
Yeah. I'm sorry that it was the accordion.
Oh, you're sorry that it was the accordion? Oh.
Yeah.
Why do you have
yes,
to apologize?
I'm guilty. Yes, I'm guilty that it was the accordion.
Well, the accordion is like the hippest instrument now. I don't have to tell you that. You
know? Not when I play it.
Not when you played it. The whole Lady of Spain bit?
Yeah, I think every Jewish and Italian boy cannot get out of Brooklyn, New York unless he learns how to play the accordion. There's a guard at the Brooklyn Bridge, and you have to play Lady of Spain before you can go over the bridge. Everybody I knew played the accordion badly. I happened to, you know, because I was more musical than the rest of my friends, I kind of got through Havana Gila and Lady of Spain, and I was... I actually entertained my relatives. You know, they just thought it was the greatest thing. It really wasn't the thing that turned my musical motor on, I can tell you. But you're right. There are people who play the accordion and actually make it sound good. I was not one of those people.
Did you sing when you played?
No, I never sang. I didn't sing until I started making records. I never really thought of myself as a singer. Singing was for other people to do. Right. Performing was for other people to do. I was... If I was going to have a career in music at all, it was going to be as a musician. And that was it. No, I never sang.
Barry Manilow speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Barry Manilow. He has a new CD concert recording called Two Nights Live and a new live in-concert DVD titled Ultimate Manilow. He spoke with Terry Gross in 2002.
Now, you said that your stepfather introduced you to jazz, to music that you really loved.
Yeah.
Tell us about how he introduced you to the music you fell in love with.
Well, when my mother remarried, the three of us moved into a little apartment still in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And he brought with him a stack of records that I had never heard of before. Records that were included people like June Christie, Chris Connors, Stan Kenton, lots of Broadway musical soundtracks, a lot of jazz, Chet Baker, Jerry Mulligan, some classical music. I had never been exposed to that kind of thing. I was raised for the first part of my life by my mother and my grandparents, who were all very musical, but not in the musical world. But Willie was. And I devoured this stack of music. I memorized every note from every overture, every lick that anybody sang or played. And it was really the beginning of my musical passion for what wound up to be a career. But had I not been exposed to that at the tender age of like 12 or 13, I really don't think I would have gone into the music business. I wouldn't have known what to do.
How did you ditch the accordion and start playing piano?
Actually, he did it. He convinced my mother to buy a spinet piano. So we got a spinet piano in our little apartment, and they pooled their money together and gave me piano lessons. And I began to love making music more so than I ever did before.
Now, was jazz playing something that you picked up by ear, or something that your teacher was actually able to help you with?
No, it was by ear. I think jazz, you can't be taught jazz. You listen to it and then you do your own version of it. But I, you know, you, well, for me at least, I needed to know the rules of music. I needed to know the language of music, and that's what the lessons were so handy for.
Now, you've said that when you were in college, you expected to have a pretty conventional life, get married, get a good job, live in the suburbs. What changed your mind and made you pursue music?
It was coming out of my ears, and it just wouldn't leave me alone. I tried everything not to follow this muse that would not leave me alone. Because coming from where I come from, a four-floor, six-flight walk-up, where people were just struggling to make the rent every Friday, that paycheck every Friday was the most important thing. That's what I learned. You know, there was really no way that anybody would take the risk and go into the biz, show biz, the music biz. You know, the most important thing was security. So no matter how much I loved it, and I played in jazz bands, and I won the Best Musician Award in high school and all, it never dawned on me that I was going to make a career out of it, because it just was too risky. But I just kept getting these offers to do things musically. I got a job at CBS as a log clerk, first as a mailboy, then I was a log clerk when I was jotting down times of television commercials, and I had this, this regular 9-to-5 life plotted out for me. But whenever I'd play or arrange for somebody, I would keep getting these offers to go further than just my 9-to-5 job, and I finally took one, and I took a chance, and I left CBS, and I never looked back.
When you first started working professionally, I think it was in more of a supporting role, working like you had an act with a woman singer. I think Jeannie was her name.
Yes.
And so you did some arranging for her. You were the pianist. You sang some duets with her. But it was kind of, it sounds from your book like it was a kind of supporting role. Did you see yourself as being like a supporting role type of character in music?
Well, if I saw myself at all in music, and like I said, it was so risky, I never even dreamed about even that. But if I were to imagine myself in the music business at that time, it would have been in a supporting role, as an arranger, as a pianist, as a producer, as a songwriter. Those were my goals. Those were my dreams. Those were my fantasies, that one day, if I ever took the risk, that's where I would wind up. And so my first professional engagement was as an accompanist for many, many singers, and Jeannie was one of them.
Well, your most famous position in a supporting role was as Bette Midler's accompanist and music arranger, and this was in the era when she was playing at the Continental Baths, the gay steam bath in Manhattan. How did you meet Bette Midler?
Well, she was one of the dozens of girl and boy singers that I was accompanying. I had left CBS, and I had begun accompanying singers, and I was making a really healthy living. Because I'm really a good accompanist. I'm not that great a pianist, but I'm a really good accompanist. And they are always in demand in New York for auditions and people who need arranging and coaching and stuff. So before I knew it, I was coaching just about every singer that needed a pianist. I was booked like 12 hours a day. And Bette must have heard of me and called me and asked if I would play a couple of weekends for her at this place called the Continental Bath. So I worked for a couple of weekends for her. I subbed for her, the piano player that she had. And she exploded and asked me if I would stay along with her. And I frankly didn't want to just work for one person. And she couldn't afford to, really just, pay me for, 24 hours a day. But Bette Midler was so incredibly talented that I just could not say no. And I began to work for her exclusively.
What was your role in her act? I mean, were you just quiet at the piano, or did you participate in any of the banter or sing duets?
No. That again, I was not up to singing then. That was still, this was still before I began to sing. In the beginning, I just arranged her music, put her act together, tightened it up, led her band, hired the background singers, taught them what to sing. I put her whole musical part of her show together.
Could you talk a little bit about what it was like to play to an audience in a gay steam bath?
Well, I only worked there for 2 weekends. People got, there's this unbelievable reputation that both Bette and I had, you know, about working in, you know, all the gay bathhouses of all around the world, you know, in Iran and Paris. But it really was, I don't know how long she worked there, but I know for me it was only 2 weekends. And it was a nightclub situation there, although they were in towels, but it was a nightclub situation. And there was a stage and lights and a sound system. And Bette would come out and do her brilliant hour and a half. And they would freak out. And after the 2 weekends, she got booked at a place called The Upstairs at the Downstairs, which was in Manhattan. And that was it. That was the end of my experience at the Continental Baths. But a lot of other people worked at the baths because it was, like I said, it was a really interesting nightclub situation. And the audiences were fantastic to the performers.
Barry Manilow speaking with Terry Gross. We'll continue their conversation in the second half of the show. Here's Bette Midler, recorded in 1972. This was arranged and conducted by Barry Manilow. He's also at the piano. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt, smoothies, and cultured soy. 10% of profits are donated to support environmental causes and family farms. Details at stonyfield.com. And from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of A Season for the Dead, a new crime novel set in modern-day Rome by David Hewson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, platform shoes and feeling self-conscious on stage. We continue our conversation with Barry Manilow. And David Edelstein reviews Man on Fire, the latest revenge film starring Denzel Washington. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Barry Manilow. He was one of the biggest pop hitmakers of the 70s and early 80s. He has a new live collection called Two Nights Live. Here's the original recording of his first big hit, Mandy.
I remember all my life, raining down as cold as ice, shadows of a man, a face through a window, crying in the night. The night goes into morning, just another day. Happy people pass my way, looking in their eyes, I see a memory.
Did you think, well, I'm gonna be the one by the microphone. I'm gonna be the one singing. I'm gonna have my own act. What led you to that point?
You know, I was. It felt to me. Still seems to me that I was not in charge of that until way, way into my career. It felt like I was just catching up. I was just keeping up barely because when this opportunity to sing for myself came up. I was very reluctant to pursue this. I, first of all, didn't believe that I had any right to be a singer. I didn't think that I had a voice. I didn't think that I had a style. I didn't think that, and frankly, it wasn't anything that I'd ever aspired to anyway. But I got this record offer, a contract offer, because somebody had heard my demos that I had sung. I had sung my own songs. And I was trying to get other people to record them, but I couldn't afford other singers, so I sang them myself. And I got an offer to make a record, because Bell Records thought that I don't know what they thought. They liked what they heard. And I was so interested in promoting my own songs that if that was the only way to do it, I took it. But they said that they wouldn't give me this deal unless I promised to go out and put a show together and promote it. Well, that I just didn't know how to do that, but I was still conducting for Bette, and I asked her if I could sing a few songs to open her second act. And in that way, I would tour to promote my album, and I would also stay a music director for her show. And she let me do it. So I would conduct her first act, then I would open her second act with three of my songs from this new album that I had made, and then I would continue to conduct it. So that kind of worked out great.
When you were doing demos, what kind of person were you hoping would record your song? Like, who were you looking at?
Who were the singers? Andy Williams. Who were the singers that needed Nancy Wilson? Shirley Bassey, Tom Jones. This was the end of the '60s, and those were the kinds of singers that were recording other people's material. But at the same time, there was the new crop of young singer-songwriters, which, little did I know, I was one of.
Right.
But I didn't know that. I was still trying to come from that old Tin Pan Alley school where you wrote songs for other people to record. So I was just writing songs that seemed like they could be recorded by other people. And little did I know that I was going to be the one that did it.
Were you the first person to record one of your own songs?
Yeah, I was. Yes, I was. I was the first person to record one of my own songs. If you don't want to count, State Farm is there.
Is that one of your commercials?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you wrote a lot of jingles before you made it as a performer.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, so how does the whole thing go? What's the first line in that? The State Farm
but
is
like
there.
Like a good neighbor,
yeah.
State Farm is there, yeah.
Oh, wow.
A very talented girl named Leslie Miller recorded that one after I wrote it, and then there was another one called I Am Stuck on Band-Aids and a Band-Aid Stuck on Me, and there was a whole batch of little kids that recorded that. But, I mean, you know, I wouldn't consider that was, you know, my first hit, you know.
Well, let me back up to that. How did you start writing commercials? You know, we've got you going from Bette Midler's music director to recording demos and recording yourself. Where do the commercials fit in?
Well, when I was sending my demos out, a commercial agent heard some of these demos, and they thought that I was writing commercially. And they called me and said, do you want to go up for a Dodge commercial? And I said, sure. So I wrote a Dodge a commercial, the melody to the lyric that they gave me. And because my commercial, not knowing anything, came in like, you know, at 4 minutes or something. I'm supposed to write it for 30 seconds, you know. And but they liked the melody. And ultimately, as we pared the whole thing down to 30 seconds, I got it. I got the first one I went up for. And then they kept calling me to write various jingles. And State Farm and Band-Aids are the ones that people still remember.
Well, what about,
I think they're still playing them.
What about the McDonald's Have It Your Way? Isn't that one yours?
No, that it was You Deserve a Break Today.
Oh, yeah, You Deserve a Break Today. Right. That was
right.
Yours,
I only sang on that one. I was part of the vocal group. I got into the commercial world while I was conducting for Bette. You see, when I started, I stopped accompanying everybody except Bette. But like I said, she couldn't afford to keep me on salary. So I was really making a handsome living doing these commercials. And so between the two of them, I was able to support myself.
Now, what did you learn about the craft of songwriting from writing commercial jingles?
Well, I attended the New York College of Music, and a little while I went to Juilliard. And even though that was a pretty good training for my brains, the commercial world, my 3 years in the commercial world was really the college that I went to, because I got to work with the top musicians. You know, they pay so well. You work with the top studio musicians who taught me really how to arrange music. You know, the oboe player would say, "Psst, come on over here. You see this thing? It's, you're writing it too high." I'd say, "Really? I'm writing it too high?" "Yeah, the oboe can't go up that high, so take it down an octave." This would go on and on. I worked with the great, great studio singers who taught me how to harmonize and how to change the timbre of my voice. I worked with these great engineers who I would stand behind and I would see how they made these jingles sound so hot that they would jump out of the radio. And as far as the songwriting goes, well, you're up against so many fantastic songwriters that you've got to write the catchiest melody in 30 seconds. If you don't write it, if you don't write the best one, then the other guys get it. And so for 3 years, I was in school, and I'll never forget that.
Now, did you ever come up with a hook for a jingle and think, wait a minute, that's really a song. It's not a jingle. I'm keeping that one for myself.
A lot of them. But, you know, once you start to write 30-second jingles, they really don't want to be much more than 30-second jingles.
Uh-huh. So, like, there were ideas coming to you that you knew were just, like, 30-second ideas.
Yeah, they're great hooks, but every time I tried to expand them, they didn't work.
Right, so there's no bridge to You Deserve a Break Today.
No, there's no bridge to You Deserve a Break, and there's no bridge to State Farm Is There. You know, I mean, State Farm Is There is such a pretty little melody, you know, that it could be a melody, but frankly, it's probably better as a commercial.
Barry Manilow speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Barry Manilow. He spoke with Terry Gross in 2002.
Let's get back to when you started performing after being more behind the scenes as a music director and writing commercial jingles. Were you self-conscious those first few times when you got up on stage and you were at the front of the stage?
I would say I was the geek. I was the geek of all time on the stage. I really didn't know what I was doing up there. I can't express how uncomfortable I was walking out on a stage, having the spotlight hit me, and me having to lead the evening.
And what about that experience made you so uncomfortable?
Well, I had never practiced for it. I had never imagined it. I had never thought about it. All I really ever thought about was making music, not performing music. And so it was a very uncomfortable, scary experience for me. But the amazing part about that was that the audience never had trouble with it, ever. From the very first moment I hit the stage and sang my own songs, the audiences never had the kind of trouble that I was having accepting this new role.
What did you think it took to be a good performer or entertainer that you were afraid you might not have?
style, confidence, experience, not being self-conscious. Those were all the things that I, you know, that I didn't have. I was very self-conscious. I didn't know my way around a stage. I didn't know the rules of performing. You know, I didn't know what to do with my legs. I was just.
What about your arms?
Or my arms, forget about my legs. What am I going to do? I mean, I would stand there, you know, and I know that I would feel like, naked and vulnerable. And the audiences loved that.
Maybe they identified with your self-consciousness.
Maybe they did. Whatever it was, I was very comfortable sitting at the piano singing Could It Be Magic, but then, you know, having to talk with them and stand up and you know, lead a whole hour-long set, it was torture. It was just torture for me. I was just very uncomfortable for many, many years.
When you were having all those top 10 hits, this was the 70s and the 80s. Now, all of us who remember then know that, well, most of us were fashion victims of one sort or another during that era, particularly in the 70s. Were there were some pretty frightening things that we all wore, that we all participated in. As a performer, I think it's even worse for performers, because performers have to wear more extreme versions of whatever.
And you're tortured with them for the rest of your life.
Yeah, like, here I am bringing it up again for you. So what are some of your worst fashion memories?
Well, you know, I looked just like Rod Stewart and Elton John did. You know, we all looked like idiots back then. You know,
white suits.
The glitter and the, you know, bell bottoms and the platform shoes and the puka bees, and I frankly looked like Britney Spears back then with my long blonde hair, really, but before the boob job.
Oh, exactly. I was gonna mention that was me. David Rakoff did an interview with you in the Sunday New York Times Magazine.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned that the Smithsonian had asked for your Copacabana jacket, which you
really
described.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, you described it as being a huge ruffled Desi Arnaz Babalu kind of thing.
And it is. I did it as a joke in 1978, and you know, and somebody took a photo of me, and you know, from that moment on, I was sunk. I was just sunk. You know, I did it as a joke, but I think people, you know, thought that I was serious.
We said that the Smithsonian asked you for the jacket. You sent it to them, and then they sent it back to you.
Well, here's the real story is this. I just put my foot in my mouth. They asked me for the jacket, and you know, it's such a funny jacket. It's a joke. And so when I got it, I was interviewed. And the interviewer said, it's going to the Smithsonian. I said, yeah, I always knew it was going to wind up in an institution. And the Smithsonian got so insulted, they sent it back.
Oh. So where is the jacket now?
Oh, it lives in my offices in Los Angeles. And it's still as silly as it ever was, but now it has a little bit more meaning for me.
What are some of your favorite things from the very early part of your career when you were just taking off, or, you know, from the 70s or early 80s, things that are either in your closets or on your walls?
Well, I have these platform shoes that we all wore, and I made a planter out of them.
That's perfect. And where do you keep it?
I don't know. Where do I keep it? I think I keep it in my studio. It's just a reminder of what never to do again.
Very good. How do you dress now on stage?
Oh, I'm very dapper now. I just wear like clothes, and there's no costumes anymore. I mean, are people wearing costumes? God, I don't know. I see people on stage wearing sweatsuits or something. You know, I can't go as far as that.
No, I have a question for you, and I know you're asked this a lot, but has it bothered you that although you've had this huge success over the years, there's also been people, you know, listeners and some critics who like use the word syrupy to describe your music, and you know, you've been the butt of jokes and in some articles and other places. Is that difficult to handle? Does it bug you?
Now and again, it does. I'm, you know, human. So yeah, it does. I go into self-pity for a while, and I pull the covers over my head like any human being would do. But it doesn't. It never really stopped me. Mostly because I believe in what I do. I listen to these songs, you know, trying to get the feeling, and this one's for you, and when October goes, and I say, well, I like them. I think they sound great. And, you know, my band likes them, and the audiences like them. And so I just keep going. I just keep doing what I love doing and hope that there's an audience out there for it. And I was always surprised at the critics when they felt they needed to be so mean-spirited in their opinions to somebody that they never even met. But I forgave them. The little creeps for making my life miserable all those years. But, you know, the best revenge is, like I said before, you know, I continue to get the opportunity to make music, to make the music that I love to make. And so that's really the best revenge.
Are you still self-conscious when you're performing?
No, not anymore. Not anymore. I am a sex god now. And I accept it. I have accepted the fact that I am a sex god. And
have women ever thrown panties at you and done that whole bit?
Only once. Only once. And I thought maybe she was asking me to take it out to the laundry, you know.
where was this?
It was in Vegas. Where else would they do that?
Exactly,
and
right.
So, but no, they usually throw, they don't throw very much things at me. They, you know, little soft teddy bears and roses and stuff. It's always very nice. No, I'm very comfortable on the stage these days, much more comfortable than I ever thought I would ever be. And it hit around, I would say, 10, 11, 12 years ago. When I finally accepted that this was not going to stop, this was not going to go away. It seemed to be getting bigger, and I had better learn how to make myself comfortable on that stage, or else I was going to be a very miserable old man.
Right.
And I took acting classes.
Oh.
Took acting classes from a brilliant acting teacher and actress named Nina Foch, F-O-C-H. She was and is one of the great actresses of her time in the 40s and still works a lot. And when I started taking acting lessons, it was the first time I realized that what I was doing, there were rules for what I was doing. For those first, I'd say, 10 years, I was meandering around the stage, trying to crawl into a lyric as honestly as I could, but because I'd never thought about actions and motivations reasons for singing or reasons for moving on a stage, it always felt so unsafe to me because I didn't know where I was. I didn't know why I was doing it. As soon as I began to take acting lessons, not that I'm a great actor, but I was able to learn the rules of acting. You break down a script. You don't walk unless you have a reason to walk. You don't speak unless you know who you're speaking to. These were the rules that I guess other performers know how to do that. I didn't. I was just flying by the seat of my pants, and luckily the audiences liked it. And again, because I had the music to rely on, and I was pretty good at that, I was able to get through it. But emotionally, I was a wreck every night because I had no rules. I was out of control. As soon as I finished taking acting classes, or in the middle of it, I began to learn the rules of what you do when you're on a stage. And it was the thing that saved my life as a performer.
Did it help you figure out how to inhabit a song when you were singing it? How to kind of give the impression of sadness if you were singing a sad song, or of exuberance if you were singing Daybreak?
Well, you know, as an actor, I put my imaginary partner out in front of me, and I sing even now to her, or to my grandfather, or to whoever, you know, happens to come to my mind at that moment. And the audience doesn't need to necessarily know that, but they know something. They know that I'm connecting with somebody, and I think it makes the performances much more powerful than if I was closing my eyes and, you know, doodling the song as so many performers do these days. I think, you know, the difference between an actor and a singer is you open your eyes.
Barry Manilow speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. His new live CD set is called Two Nights Live. There's also a new DVD of his live performances called Ultimate Manilow. Coming up, David Edelstein on Man on Fire with Denzel Washington and Hollywood's growing crop of revenge films. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. In the new thriller Man on Fire, Denzel Washington plays a drunken government assassin who tries to restart his life as a bodyguard for the daughter of a wealthy family in Mexico City. But the relationship is short-lived, and Washington ends up torturing and killing everyone who crossed him. Yes, it's another revenge movie, and film critic David Edelstein has had just about enough.
Once again, payback dominates the box office. Last week it was Kill Bill Volume 2 and The Punisher. Now comes Man on Fire with Denzel Washington, which makes The Punisher look like Shakespeare. I've always been of two minds about revenge movies. As a critic, I get downright moralistic about the ways they make their audiences drool for blood. Yet I admit, I keep going to them. I'm the perfect vengeance maven. I'm angry at injustice, enraged by my own powerlessness, and addicted to scenarios of injury followed by holy retribution. It worries me how in touch I am with the Punisher in myself, wanting the child molester to take a shiv in prison, or at the other extreme, to beat up the guy who cuts in front of me in line. It's a mad, 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 mad world, and this is a genre that caters to that madness, and even, I feel certain, reinforces it. It's important to say that humans have always gone for tit-for-tat scenarios. One of our earliest epics, The Odyssey, closes with bloody retribution, and that's for people merely lusting after the hero's wife when they thought he was dead, not for doing anything. The Jacobeans made a specialty of celebrating bloodthirsty Machiavellian revengers, but I think even they would blanch at the hero of Man on Fire. Denzel Washington is Creasy, the alcoholic bodyguard of a little girl in Mexico, played by blonde moppet Dakota Fanning, who's kidnapped, held for ransom, then, well, some bad things happen. The Bible-toting Creasy doesn't turn the other cheek. He goes on a punishment spree that's sexed up by the director, Tony Scott, who's like an old white guy trying to be a rap master, zooming in and out, mixing film stocks, superimposing shrieking victims, making even the subtitles dance. In the early 60s, it was shocking when 007 had License to Kill. Now the hero has license to torture first. He cuts off fingers one by one. He shreds ears. He gets his info and pulls the trigger anyway. His friend, played by Christopher Walken, tells a sympathetic inspector, he'll deliver more justice in a weekend than 10 years of your courts and tribunals. Creasy's art is death. He's about to paint his masterpiece. And then Creasy, the impassive avenging angel, has a banner vigilante line. Forgiveness is between them and God. It's my job to arrange the meeting. In this scene, he stuffs a time bomb up the rectum of a corrupt police official who expects his confession to get him off.
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry for the girl. It was just business. You know, I'm a professional.
That's what everybody keeps saying. I'm just a professional. Everybody keeps saying that to me. I'm just a professional. I'm just a professional. I'm getting sick and tired of hearing that. You understand me?
What are you going to do now?
What am I going to do? I'm going to leave. I got to go.
Go?
Yeah, I got
to. Okay, come on, come on. What about me?
Well, what about you? You've got 40 seconds.
Come on.
45.
Come on. Last wish, please, please, please.
Last wish. I wish you had more time.
Hey. Hey, hey.
Kaboom! I'd love to keep summarizing the horrors of Man on Fire, but it would be more helpful to mention movies, all of them on DVD, that give you the kick of a vengeance scenario, and something else, a view of the Avenger that's tragic, or at least double-edged. In John Ford's The Searchers, the motives of its obsessed protagonist, played by John Wayne, become more and more questionable, until he's on the verge of executing the niece whom he's rescued from the Comanches. And then he becomes the movie's racist villain. Taxi Driver was inspired by The Searchers, and also the life of would-be George Wallace assassin Arthur Bremmer, and that even more thoroughly blurs the line between heroism and sociopathic obsession. In The Limey, a father's similarly ferocious hunt for the killer of his daughter ends when he learns that the ultimate responsibility for her death was his. In The Bedroom, features a climactic act of revenge by the mild, humane protagonist that clearly violates his own nature and effectively ends his life. Then, of course, there's the ultimate conflicted Avenger work, Hamlet, especially the inspired modern take by Michael Almereyda, whom I should mention is a friend. In this version, Ethan Hawke recites To Be or Not to Be while pacing the action aisles of a Blockbuster video store, his irresolution mocked by rows of revenge pictures. Quentin Tarantino has said that A Kill Bill Volume 3 will have as its heroine the grown daughter of Vernita Green, who watched the bride kill her mother at the start of Volume 1 and now wants justice. That's a great idea, because it dramatizes the way that even righteous avengers set in motion blood feuds that victimize innocence and span generations. It's payback that pays you back.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate.
I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. You know you've done me wrong. You stole my wife and gone. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you.
Talk about it, Jordan, talk about it.
I'm gonna kill you just for fun, you rascal, you. I'm gonna kill you just for fun, you rascal, you. I'm gonna kill you just for fun. The bugs can have you when I'm done. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you.
Ah, let me talk about him a while. You asked my wife for some cabbage, you dog.
That's Louis Armstrong with Louis Jordan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Pettis Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Run, Satch! There ain't no use in him running, you rascal, you.
Catch up with him, catch up with him.
There ain't no use in you to run, because I done went to the
park. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Destructive Emotions, How Can We Overcome Them?, a scientific dialogue with the Dalai Lama, narrated by Daniel Goleman. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the saddest music in the world. It's a new film by avant-garde Canadian director Guy Madden, starring Isabella Rossellini as a beer baroness in search of, yes, the saddest music in the world. The Depression-era musical is shot mostly in black and white. Join us for the next Fresh Air.